This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik. It's Friday afternoon, so it's our Doctor in the House show. And today, the Doctor in the House meets the first Professor of Urology in Cambridge University, who was from Malaysia. So this is exciting, isn't it, George? How are you?
Very exciting, you know. Well, last month, we had the opportunity to interview UK-based Malaysian scientist Dr. Serena Nick Zainal about her work, you know, which is dubbed the Nobel Prize of Cancer Research, and then it's breakthrough research work. And with so much excitement, and of course, it's appropriate for the month of November that we interview somebody who's really focusing on his work in cancer research, especially prostate cancer, and a Malaysian who made the first urological professor in Cambridge University's 800 years history, right?
Yes. So Professor Vincent Nyanaprakasam, also an honorary consultant urologist at Adam Brooks Hospital in Cambridge, is joining us today. And we would like him to share with us his journey in terms of his academic career. Very importantly, his clinical work in personalized medicine, his research, some award-winning innovations that he has been driving, all aimed at improving the treatment of prostate cancer and outcomes for men overall. So just a quick shout out, our phone lines are open, 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. If you have questions, thoughts, anything that you'd like to share related to what we'll be discussing today. Professor Vincent, how are you all the way over in the UK?
Very well, and thank you so much for having me on the show. It's a great pleasure to speak to you, and also to hear about this segment, which I think is fantastic for your Malaysian audience. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So from La Salle in Petaling Jaya to Cambridge, Professor, way of Newcastle. Yeah. Why don't you share a bit about your education, a bit about your life in Malaysia before you went on to pursue your career?
Yeah, so I sometimes draw a little map on all the places I've been through to get to where I am. Actually, as you say, I started in La Salle PJ, those of you who know Jalan Gasing will know the school there. So was there until primary years. Then I went to Singapore to do some secondary education. Dad was keen that we had a good education opportunity. So I was there. I did my, as they call them then, O-levels and A-levels. And then from there to Newcastle. Actually, I always thought that at some point I'd come back to Malaysia, but the opportunities were just took me into different places. Then I was been in Newcastle for some 20 years and from there to Cambridge. So yeah, a bit of a nomad, really. I'm not quite sure I've ever been in one place for too long, shall we say. Mm. I'm not even sure if I'll be here in Cambridge. Who knows? Maybe there's another adventure somewhere else. I've not been further west or east yet, so maybe that's the next one to try.
New lands waiting for you. But, you know, the La Salle alumni are all very pleased with themselves right now, I'm sure. So 13 years in Cambridge, if I'm not mistaken, Prof. Yeah. And you are both professor as well as clinical consultant. You know, why juggle both?
So to be frank with you, I didn't come into academia by plan. It was more by circumstance and chance. I'd always planned to be a doctor first. And lacking imagination, I decided I'd do surgery. My dad was a surgeon. And it just so happened that I came across urology. I never heard about it before in medical school days. I thought it was interesting. So I thought, well, let's look at that. And it was while I was trying to do urology, and as the careers pathway is very competitive in the UK, as George will know, I decided to do some research. And then I went to see the professor at the time in Newcastle, thinking he'd have some small project. And he basically said, oh, come and see my lab. So I went to the lab and then I ended up doing lab work. And even then I thought, well, you know, I'll get the CV brushed up, good chance to get a training job. But the research was very fruitful. It got me interested. So then I went on to do a PhD in laboratory project, molecular biology. That was successful. And then, of course, it seemed a shame to not do it. So I then went on to get a clinician scientist award from Cancer Research UK. At that time, I was the first urologist and surgeon to get one, actually. And then I managed to do that together with training in urology itself. So that's how it happened. It wasn't planned. It just sort of happened to go together. And then since that time, obviously, consultant, academic work. And one thing I realized is that actually it's very hard to do both equally well. So you have to have your hat on one more than the other. And I think I could do more good with the research. There are plenty of really, really good urologists who do fantastic clinical work. So I do my specialist area, but focus a lot more on the research to try and see whether I can find a way for things to be better. So not planned.
So Vincent, do you currently see yourself as a surgeon more or as a researcher, predominantly researcher?
So George, I started off and I trained as a urological surgeon, as you know. But actually, we are all urologists first. And urology is one of those unique surgical specialities, which is actually more medicine than surgery. We deal with a lot of, it's the only surgical specialty, in my view, which has this fantastic balance of the medicine and the surgery. If you think about orthopedic surgeons, it's all about the surgery. If you go into colorectal, well, you've got a medical counterpart, the gastroenterologist who does all that. But urology that never had that. So actually, I see myself as a urologist who does research. The surgery is obviously very important, but you will also know that surgery requires a lot of time, dedication. You need to do high volumes these days. And so that is not often compatible with a high intensive research program. So I've stepped back from the surgical side. I do mainly diagnostics, urologies, and things like that.
Vincent, I mean, you clearly described your journey from earlier days. I mean, off air, we discussed early on that we're same age, and then we have kind of similar journey that we went to UK, after secondary school in Malaysia. And I was in Cambridge, and I described to you what it was like working for three consultants at that time. When we are in medical school, you have this kind of like a two-week allocation to do urology, and urology just never got that limelight. I mean, today you described that. How many consultants do you have now in Cambridge?
Oh, we are up to what, 18, 19?
18 to 19 consultants. Yeah. So obviously the last 20 years, a lot of things has changed. In fact, the last three decades, urology gets a lot more limelight. And now, especially they created a special urology post, urology chair or professor. And then can you tell me what exactly has changed in the last three decades that actually urology gets such front stage limelight?
Well, urology is one of those strange specialities which were probably not as prominent in previous generations because people didn't live long enough. Many of the urological conditions we are dealing with are actually conditions of the older person. Certainly there are other things as well. So because of the aging population, because of the, shall we say, lives which have been saved through cardiovascular interventions and things like that, we're now starting to see the effects of old age. And you can see this evidently. Prostate cancer is predominantly a disease of the older person. Industrial diseases, contributions like smoking to bladder cancer, all these things have actually created large amounts of urological disease. So I think the specialty has grown because of a larger population and aging population. But urology also has become more prominent because it has embraced huge innovations in drug therapy, in technology, robotics, for example. Urology is one of the first to adopt that. So it has become a highly attractive specialty. And we are treating more people earlier with better and better modalities. As you will know, I think you practice in endourology, lasers for stone treatments. All these things are, really innovative. And this is what I mean when I say that urology itself is not just about the surgery. It allows huge scopes for non-interventional surgical intervention, but medical innovation, minimally invasive. So these things attract a lot of people into it. And we have a large population we have to deal with. As Malaysian health gets better, the country's mean life expectancy is going up all the time. I'm sure you are seeing in Malaysia as well, many, many more people coming with urological conditions, both benign and cancerous, which need to be addressed. And of course, don't forget that people's lifestyles change as well. We have come to expect that things shouldn't go wrong. So, for example, a man who has waterwork trouble and is getting up at night and things like that, perhaps at one time he said, oh, well, I'm just getting old. Now, that's not really acceptable. You know, what can be done to take me back to those years? Of course, you and I both know we can't do it completely. At 52, you and I, I'm sure, are also starting to feel those symptoms. George, though, I must say you're much better preserved than me, so I must find your secrets. But, you know, so I think for many factorial reasons, urology is a growing and very exciting speciality.
And Prof, what does it mean to be appointed the first professor of urology in Cambridge? What distinction does this appointment confer? And, you know, how would you personally like to take this forward?
So in Cambridge, if you are in Cambridge, you have to be you have to go through a promotions process. It's very arduous. It has very strict criteria. And the honest truth is that I was promoted to reader last year. And then this year, the university decided to change the academic titles. And so reader became professor. So obviously I'm very pleased about that. But by that process, my title changed to professor of urology. And I was very curious even last year to know, because these things are personal, they're given to an individual for, you know, going through this process. It's not something that moves from one person to the other in this case. I thought I'd find out, you know, has there ever been anyone who's done this? And turns out there hasn't been. I went to the records office the library to ask about this, and they went through their records, which go back to, you know, the early days, and there was no mention before. So that's how it came to be. Now, the truth is that when you have these titles, it doesn't come with anything other than a recognition that you've done a certain level to achieve that. And when you're in Cambridge, you know, it's very humbling to be promoted by your peers who independently look at your work and they judge you across the entire university. So you're being judged against, you know, people in a place where they've had Nobel laureates and things like that, and other people, and also at the arts and the humanities and the history and the politics and everything. So it's a very arduous and a very stringent process. So it's very humbling to be able to be promoted through that. So yes, that's the process. And in short, what does it confer? Well, it just means that I've got to do more work to make sure that I'm, you know,
worthy of the title.
Worthy of the title, exactly. So that's it, really, more hard work.
And speaking of hard work, you've already done so much, and we'll come back to look at your research work, some of your innovations, mainly in the area of prostate cancer, what you are looking towards, changing or achieving in this area of personalized medicine. What exactly does that mean? We'll go for a quick break now. My co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist on the show with me, we're speaking to Professor Vincent Nyanaprugasam, Professor of Urology at the University of Cambridge. Our lines are open, 03-7733-2900. You can also WhatsApp 018-789-8899. We'd love to hear from you. We will be right back on Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiao Ik, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, is our Doctor in the House show today. We're speaking to Professor Vincent Nyanaprugasam, Professor of Urology at the University of Cambridge, who has the distinction of being the first Professor of Urology in Cambridge University. And, you know, it's not just a title. It's not just a promotion. It is a recognition of years of distinguished work, research, as well as, Professor Vincent is also a consultant urologist at Addenbrooke's Hospital, Cambridge. So he's coming with this vast, background and experience, based on his work in looking at improving outcomes for men with prostate cancer. Now, Prof, one of the main challenges in prostate cancer is distinguishing between aggressive and non-aggressive cancer. And George and I, as well as our other host on Health and Living, we've talked so much about how prostate cancer can be a cancer you live with as a chronic disease, and if it's managed well. But coming back to distinguishing between aggressive and non-aggressive, why in this day and age is this still a challenge, and what is the difference that it could make to patients?
So that's a highly complex question. for me to address in a few minutes. But let me say this. In actual fact, there is no difficulty for us to distinguish between indolent or aggressive cancers. We actually know which are the cancers that are and aren't. The question are twofold. How do you pick up these aggressive cancers at a stage where you can do something about it while not picking up a lot of the indolent early thing cancers, which are never going to cause problems? And the reason that's important is that if you pick up a lot of people and say you've got prostate cancer, but we don't know if it's going to affect you or not, that incites a lot of worry in people, you know, unnecessary checkups and things like that, even if you don't have treatment. So there is a push to try not to pick that up. And let's be frank, that if a man lives long enough, they're going to get some kind of prostate cancer. And we know this through many, many studies. So finding it may not do an individual any good. On the flip side, there are some cancers which will progress and become problematic if not found early. So detection of how to pick up those relevant or what we call now clinically significant cancers is actually key. However, once we detect it, actually, we have a pretty good idea of how that cancer is going to behave and whether or not treatment will be beneficial. And some of the work that I've been doing is to try to really drill down using very simple clinical tools that we already have into who these men are. Because one of the key things I'm very keen on is to make healthcare either free or very cheap. So if we can do that first, actually, we can gain a huge amount already. For example, some of the simple prediction models we've developed have nearly an 80% accuracy in predicting how a man with prostate cancer will do after the diagnosis. And we can put them into these risk groups or prognostic groups, shall we say. Added tests that will come in future, genomic testing, things like that, will add on top of that. But first, we need to get the baseline correct. So I think there are two aspects to that. How do you pick up those significant cancers that if you don't find them early will go on to cause problems? And secondly, once you found them, how do we get the message across to both patients actually and doctors that perhaps some of these cancers do not need to have surgery or radiotherapy or whatever else?
Well, Vincent, I'm really looking forward to hearing your view and also, you know, hear about the data that you have about how to pick up all these people and also how to predict their outcome and what sort of a treatment they have. In Malaysia, I don't know whether you're aware that prostate cancer campaign only kind of like become more prominent in recent years. And we highlighted that 60 to 70% of men presented with prostate cancer actually presented late, which is very, very distressing to hear. I mean, is there any kind of like research work that you're doing for later stage prostate cancers? I mean, well, let's get that out of the way first before we hear about your, you know, new development and new treatment in the horizon.
Do you mean are there new treatments for locally advanced or metastatic cancer? Is that what you mean?
Or metastatic cancer, that's right. Because it's quite sad to see that in Malaysia, 60 to 70% of men presented late. And that's something that we try to change so that more and more men will come forward to have that screening test.
So they're both intricately linked questions. The first thing to say is my area of research and work is not actually in advanced and metastatic. I leave that to much, much more qualified colleagues of mine who work in oncology, medical oncology, and clinical oncology. And there is no doubt that survival rates for these advanced and metastatic have improved tremendously because, you know, there are many trials which have shown that treating both the primary, which means treating the prostate as well as treating places where cancers have gone, actually improves survival. So that's one thing. There are many new drugs now available which are prolonging survival, actually, when added to the standard, you know, hormone deprivation, which we use, or blocking of the male hormone. But to me, once you get to that stage, then really what you're doing is buying time. You cannot cure in those circumstances. So actually linked to that is that first bit. How do you find these things earlier on? And one of the things which I've become particularly interested in, George, is there is this myth, and I call it a myth in quite strong terms, that urinary symptoms are a sign of prostate cancer. Actually, the research is very clear that there's an inverse relationship, which means to say an opposite relationship. And I think that a lot of men think that because I'm passing water okay, I'm not getting up at night, that means I can't have prostate cancer. And that is a problem. In fact, by the time those symptoms come about, which is usually, as you will know, from actually benign processes of the aging prostate, nothing to do with cancer, they are found to have a raised PSA because cancer has grown separately. So I think that a lot can be done to actually say to men, look, you know, a prostate cancer is actually can be a silent killer. So, you know, get tested. There's a very simple, cheap test, as you know, called the PSA blood test, which is actually not perfect, but it's a very good starting point to at least get checked out, referred to your local friendly urologist, who will then have a chat with you about, or GP actually, have a chat about what to do next and what the best test is to do. So I think the message needs to get out to men that there's a very simple, cheap test you can avail yourself of. I don't know how that's distributed or done in the UK. I'm not saying a specific screening program, but certainly awareness that maybe when a man gets to their 50s or 60s, they should just do a bit of an MOT, as they call it in the UK. I think you would call it a JPJ check over there on your car, you know, just to give it a once over, make sure it's okay. And part of that, do a PSA.
But George, we've talked so much about how really the PSA test does have its limitations in being used as a screening tool. And, you know, if we can't even get that right, or, well, how far are we in perfecting or improving on this part, this step of the process?
Well, the situation is the same in the UK, for example. You know, PSA is still the test that is the most basic test that's used. But they pick up a lot more early stage prostate cancer. And that's what we're trying to achieve in Malaysia. Isn't that correct, Vincent?
Yeah, so here's the conundrum. As you say, PSA has a problem because it can pick up a lot of indolent cancers, and that's what you don't want to do. But what has changed is that at one time, if you had a PSA and it was raised, the only step was to have a biopsy done, which means putting a needle in the prostate, which can cause problems. Now, we have other things we do, such as an MRI scan of the prostate, which actually has very good what we call negative predictive value. And what that means is that it can actually rule out if there is anything worth investigating. So that risk has been taken out of the PSA. And where the direction of travel now is not just the PSA. The PSA is the first step. Actually, we now have these tools which can streamline who then needs to go on to have that ultimate test, which is the biopsy. And that has been the major shift and change. In fact, quite interestingly, I mentioned this a little earlier, urinary symptoms are actually inversely or oppositely related to prostate cancer, but so is prostate size. The bigger your prostate, the less likely you are to have prostate cancer, which is a really strange, but actually very highly validated observation. So if you were to go and do a PSA test, you went to see someone like George in your clinic, George, or GP, had your prostate assessed and maybe measured with a simple ultrasound, something called a PSA density can be calculated. And the PSA density, which is your PSA divided by your prostate volume, actually turns out to be pretty accurate in terms of predicting whether or not you may have prostate cancer, much better than the PSA. So there are all these things we have. The ultrasound and the clinic review is not an expensive thing. We can do MRI, which is got a cost to it, but it's taken the risk out of over-investigation, actually. So I think there has to be a new way to look at the PSA, not just as it was, but what it could be.
And is this where the prediction tool that you talked about comes in as well, the predict prostate tool that I know you have been working on? Does that then also come in as another gatekeeper to ensure that there's no over-treatment taking place? Can you walk us through that?
Yes. Well, so predict prostate is not to find prostate cancer. It's to answer the question, what to do if you have prostate cancer diagnosed? And where it's come from is from work we have done, is one of two tools we've developed in Cambridge. One of them is called the Cambridge Prognostic Groups, which is a simple tiered system. And the other one is Predict Prostate, which is a web tool, which anyone can use anywhere in the world, actually. And even patients can use it and clinicians to work out, if I have certain characteristics, what is the value of having treatment in terms of improving my chances of being alive at 10 or 15 years? The most important thing it does is it balances the benefit from dying of prostate cancer versus dying of something else. So, for example, let's say you're 80 years old and you're found to have a prostate cancer, which is of a low grade type. Now, first of all, you hear the word cancer and you think, my God, I got cancer, I must treat it, right? So if you were to do that, of course, logically, you might actually cure the cancer. But most of the time, you won't actually gain any benefit because you at 80, you may have other problems, heart problems, lung problems, things like that. and you're going to die of other causes. So Predict Prostate allows you to put those figures in and balance out and see what actually the benefit is. And a guy of 80 with a low-grade cancer, his overall survival benefit, but that means to say how many more chance of being alive at 10 or 15 years, is probably only about 1% to 2%. So that's what the tool does. It actually takes out the guesswork, if you like, and the bias which can happen if someone is not so much aware when they're talking about prostate cancer.
So, Vincent, what sort of parameters do you need in order to work out this algorithm?
Exactly the same that you're using every day, George, when you see someone with new prostate cancer. There's no fancy tests here. You just need the PSA value. You need to know the age of the patient. You need to know a few things about whether they've been in hospital or not. Then you need to know the biopsy. What did the biopsy find? What kind of Gleason's claw or grade group? This histological description. How many samples were positive on that biopsy? And that's about it, really. You put it into the model, and you can it calculates for you.
So
presumably, this is like looking on the big data that you have on all the database and work out a predicting algorithm.
So, yeah, the history is quite interesting. We started off by using a UK cohort to develop it. But very interestingly, we also, in that first paper, included a cohort from Singapore, which had Chinese, Malay, and Indians in it as well. And that was the first model. We then validated it, which means to retest it, in a very large group from Sweden. And together, the first and second cohort was over 80,000 men. Earlier this year, as part of another collaboration, we were able to see how the tool worked in America using their very large data sets there, and they had about 170,000. So really, in total, we've tested the tool in about 250,000 men. And in every test we've done so far, it shows this predictive ability of around 80% to get it right, shall we say.
And it is a web-based tool. So, for instance, can clinicians in Malaysia use it? Could George use it?
Absolutely. And in fact, when we look at the metrics, we do have users from Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, all over the place. It was designed to be internationally accessible. Because we know it's got a mixed race population in there, it actually works regardless of race.
Vincent, one of our alumni from Cambridge, Professor Teo Soo Huang, who was the CEO for Cancer Research Malaysia, also worked out similarly in breast cancer. The Asian populations are very, very different. Do you see that sort of like issues or obstacles? I know you have some data of Singaporean demographic. Would that be a minority of your big data? Would that be reflective of Asian populations' prostate cancer behavior?
So there is a huge discussion about whether prostate cancer in a man of different ethnicities behave differently. Perhaps the way to look at it is to look at the story amongst black men, which you might know. There's always been a perception that prostate cancer in black men tends to do worse than in Caucasian men. Actually, it turns out if you are like for like, meaning to say same grade, same stage, same all the other things that we look at, your outcomes will be the same. And I have no reason to think why it would be different for men of different ethnicities. So because we did actually manage to test the tool in an Asian, South Asian population of Southeast Asian, we know it works there. And in the American cohort, they actually had men of lots of different ethnicities, and there was no difference in the performance across ethnicities.
All right.
Of course, ideally, it would be fantastic to repeat this, say in Malaysia or Singapore, but you need large data sets.
Which I'm sure George can help in obtaining and working with you on. Is this what we mean by personalized medicine, Prof. Vincent?
So the word personalized medicine is very interesting because to most of us and most people, it suggests that we are using genetics or molecular tests to work out biology, which I think is absolutely correct. But personalized medicine also means actually personalizing the disease within our own context, our own lifestyles, our own other risks from other things. So I think personalized medicine starts actually with simple tools like what we've talked about today. If we have a diagnosis of something, we decide on whether the benefit or not of that treatment is in other things in our life. For example, if we have to work, what kind of treatment would actually interfere with that? We have to bring in money, so we can't be in hospital having complex things if something simple can be done. In the same way, treatments come with side effects. Treatment for prostate cancer can cause incontinence, it can cause impotence, things like that. what's the balance and value of that? So to me, personalized medicine starts with that. Then on top of that, you can layer on the biological things, the molecular tests, the genetic tests to make it even more refined. So it's quite a large spectrum.
So I guess it's important that, you know, we don't view personalized medicine as something that necessarily requires costly technology. And you said yourself, you know, making healthcare free or accessible is so important.
Absolutely. There's no point in coming up with the best algorithm or model in the world and then no one uses it because it costs too much, right? So that's where I find most value in research, actually. For me, research has to have a line of sight to delivery, and that's everything I do has that idea. Whatever I do here, I need to see how it will work there, and that's actually where the true benefit of being an academic clinician, meaning to say somebody who practices in the area of research, comes in, because you want to see that when you see the next person, you can offer something that wasn't there before because you did research to try and help you do that. If you can't do that, then there's no point being an academic clinician, I think. There are tons of really, really, really high-skilled, you know, capable scientists doing fantastic work in the lab. They're much better than I could ever do. So let me be the one who tries to translate some of that into practice and in the meantime, do what I can with what I've got.
And speaking of translating your research into practice and really seeing, you know, clinical applicability, we'll come back and discuss something called the CAMPROBE, which, you know, is supposed to improve the safety of men who have to undergo prostate biopsies. My co-host on the show with me today, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist, and we are speaking to Professor Vincent Nyanaprakasam, Professor of Urology at the University of Cambridge. Call us 03-7733-2900 or WhatsApp 018-789-8899 if you have questions or thoughts you'd like to share. We'll be right back. Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Welcome back to the show with me, T. Xiao Ik, and my co-host, Dr. George Lee, consultant urologist. We're speaking to Professor Vincent Nyanaprakasam, Professor of Urology at the University of Cambridge, about being conferred the first professorship of urology in Cambridge University, but more importantly, the research work that he has been doing to improve ways of managing prostate cancer. We can't talk enough about prostate cancer, can we, George? We just heard that sharing from a prostate cancer survivor when he joined you and Mira on the show last week. And what an inspiring story that was. And it gels nicely with exactly what Prof. Vincent and you have been sharing about today as well. You know, there have been so many advancements and there's so much potential in the way we can look at improving treatment for men who have been diagnosed. It's not a one-size-fits-all approach. But very interestingly, Professor Vincent has been involved in developing something called the CAMPROBE, a gadget that can conduct prostate biopsies more safely for patients. Prof, you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
So one of the risky bits about trying to find prostate cancer is the process of a prostate biopsy. And what effectively that means is putting a needle into the prostate to try and take a sample. And traditionally, and even now, the most common way to do that is to put an ultrasound probe in the back passage, in the rectum, and through that probe, put this needle through the back passage wall into the prostate. The problem, and it's very good, it's highly, you know, it's a very good diagnostic tool, and it's been around for, well, nearly 50 years. But the problem with that approach has always been the fact that you're obviously going through the bowel, which has a lot of bugs. And so the risk of infection and sepsis or, you know, serious infection has always been a problem. And in fact, a growing one because of antibiotic resistance. So the alternative is to do a biopsy to the transperineal route. Now, what that means is that area between the legs and underneath the scrotum or testicles is another route to actually go through to try and take a sample of the prostate. And in fact, that was the original way the biopsies were done. But as you know, well, as anybody would know, it's quite a sensitive area, so it can be quite painful. But people, urologists have been using that route, usually under general anesthetic, when they need to go and take more samples from the prostate, and particularly to try to get to the prostate. And the prostate obviously sits below the bladder in that area. It's a bit like an apple there. And urologists have been using this transperineal needle, but because it's painful, usually under general anesthetic. So the CAM probe is a simple device which we developed in Cambridge to allow you to do these transperineal biopsies under local anesthetic, which means that you can do it as an outpatient setting. And it is now, at the time we started developing it, there were not any devices out there. There are a few others around, but the CAM probe was designed specifically to be low cost, to be simple to use, and to be usable in any outpatient or any setting anywhere in the world. There is actually a video of it on YouTube, which listeners and clinicians can have a look at. So that was a device that we developed, interestingly, as a prototype in our hospital's engineering department. They actually made a surgical steel version, which we designed on the back of an envelope, actually. And they made a few, about 10 of those. We did a trial and it worked. And then luckily, the National Institute of Health Research in the UK, through its invention funding scheme, gave us money to develop it into a disposable. And that we have done and put it to a clinical trial, which we've published. And now that device is going through the regulatory CE marking or the CIRM marking process in Malaysia, it will be called, hopefully to be launched next year.
And how have you managed to address the pain issue then?
Because it's local anesthetic, it actually has an integrated system that delivers local anesthetic as it's inserted. Mm. So this takes out a lot of the additional requirements of having to put local anesthetic first and numb the area, that sort of thing. So we try to address all these issues, like how do you make it less painful? How do you make it more comfortable? Interestingly enough, once you get past the skin and the muscle and things, the prostate itself has no sensation. It has no pain fibers. So you can take the samples once you've got the device in. It's probably going into the detail would bore you and your listeners, but you can see the video if anyone's interested. But it's designed to try to address those specific issues.
But I guess more importantly, because it's aimed at lowering infection risk, how did it perform in clinical trials in that aspect?
No infections at all, and no sepsis at all.
What do you think, George?
Well, actually, it naturally will make sense because transrectal ultrasound scan, number one, it's very, very uncomfortable in terms of invasiveness. Something is being stuck up your probe, stuck up your backside. Secondly, naturally, you would think that all the feces in their transmission into the prostate can be quite dangerous because something called sepsis can occur and then that can create mortality. So something like what Vincent has developed definitely will have an opportunity, and then that will probably encourage more men to come forward to have biopsy, because one of the issues that men are so worrying about is that the fear of embarrassment and all to have demeaning rectal examination and things stick up their backside, and then all these measures in order to reduce that embarrassment and taboo, I think will be extremely helpful in increasing the number of men coming forward.
So, Prof. Vincent, what's next? You are also looking at the use of molecular profiling to help treatment decisions. Tell us what you have in the pipeline.
So, like I mentioned, the way I see this is that first we need to get the basics right. And I actually started life out as a molecular biology scientist. I had my own lab group doing research work. But I realized that actually whatever I was finding was probably not going to be translatable, or at least I wasn't sure how to translate it. So that made me sort of take a reality check to say, first, I need to look at the clinical setting and see whether we can get that better. Now that we've developed the tools I've mentioned to you and we can get this sort of like up to 80% accuracy, the question now is, how do we now go back and look at some of these new innovations, genetic tests and molecular markers to even get that even better? So that's something we've been pioneering here. And in fact, interestingly, some of the new tools that we have, such as safer biopsies using MRI scans, are allowing us to be much more accurate in taking prostate cancer tissue at the time of diagnosis and sending it to the lab to look for genetic signatures. And again, I'm very interested not just in what they find, but actually how do you apply it back again? There's lots of research on all these abnormalities, but how do you use it? What does it mean to an individual? That's the area which I'm particularly interested. The other thing I'm really interested in is this idea of surveillance or monitoring of early disease and how you can actually track that and predict how it's going to behave. And if you can, actually, how about actually slowing it down? Can you do something to slow this cancer from progressing, much like we try to slow down hypertension or diabetes. We use drugs. We don't cure diabetes. We control it. So can you control prostate cancer so that in future, you know, you may get a diagnosis as an early stage and then you have maybe some medication or something like that, keeps it chronic. And then a victory for prostate cancer is when you die of something else. So that's the kind of thing which I think is really interesting and exciting. And as ever, you know, how do you actually apply it? That's a bit of like my every morning I wake up and think, how do I apply it?
Absolutely. I mean, coming back to the point that George made earlier, in Malaysia, 60 to 70% of prostate cancers are still diagnosed at the late stages. At the end of the day, we need to bring them in earlier. Apart from everything that we've talked about, especially in terms of how we can improve the use of PSA, what are your thoughts on making sure there's clinical impact in this most needed area?
In the end of the day, it's about awareness. It's about actually just making men aware that this is something that could happen. I don't know the statistics and the rate of prostate cancer diagnosis in Malaysia, whether it's going up or stable, but I suspect it's going up. It's about awareness, actually, and that is does not need clinicians or innovative tests and things like that. Simple messaging like what you're doing here is important. You know, how do you get it out to all the different languages and different communities you have there? We are all living longer. The Malaysian population is getting older. These are going to become more and more issues that happen. So that is more about messaging. And in a way, it's something which needs to come from government. It needs to come from political bodies.
What do you see as the moonshot in prostate cancer research, Prof. Vincent? Is a cure something that you keep your eye on, or, you know, what's the ultimate goal?
For sure, we can cure prostate cancer, but that requires invasive treatments, whatever that might be, or tissue destructive treatments or some kind of radiation. Question is, do you really need to treat it? So I think that if you ask me for a moonshot, I would say, how do we make prostate cancer a chronic disease which is controllable? That is the key. If we can do that, then actually we can, you know, and forget about words like cure. It's about actually not dying or suffering from prostate cancer. How do you get that? Well, there's about 1 million papers in the literature on how to do that. I don't have the magic bullet, but that's what I would see as being the achievable aim.
What do you think, George?
Well, I agree that at the end of the day, prostate cancer is something that will stay, and then the way to do it is to tease out the pussycat and the tigers, and the pussycats will stay pussycat forever, and then more tigers can be tamed into pussycats, then a lot of us will die with prostate cancer rather than die of prostate cancer.
I prefer to think of it as living with prostate cancer. living with a chronic condition, right? You manage it.
It's like what we're facing with COVID-19, right? At the end of the day, we can't get rid of it. We just have to live with COVID-19, right?
And live well with it.
Exactly. That's right. The analogy I would say, actually.
Any final message, Prof. Vincent?
Well, first of all, thank you very much for having me on. It's been a real pleasure. I hope that in future, there's opportunities to do research in Malaysia. Maybe, George, that's an option there. I think that, you know, the key thing here is to not be scared of prostate cancer or being diagnosed with it. I think I heard on one of your short clips just now about someone saying that, you know, people should not fear it. And that's usually the reaction I have when I see a man and tell him the new diagnosis. And then when I start to explain that, like, look, your chance of dying of something else is like 10 times higher, you can immediately see all the anxiety goes. So I think not fearing it, coming forward to get tested, is the key thing I would say is important to do.
George?
Well, Vincent, I mean, I wanted to ask you this question. I wanted to ask you, when are you coming back to Malaysia and then actually serve the country? I guess judging from all the things that you mentioned, Cambridge is going to keep you busy for many, many years ahead of you. And also, I'm sure you're going to do great works and then translational work that will be applicable in Malaysia and across the world. The other thing I want to mention is that many of our colleagues are listening at the moment because today is the first day of our Malaysian Urological Association Congress. And I must tell you that as a urologist and also all the fellow Malaysians, we're incredibly proud of you because you really, really are flying the flags for Malaysian to be the first and only urological professor. And seriously, although you are in a way, you're in the UK and really not with us, but we are incredibly proud of you.
That is so kind of you, George. May I say, though, that what I try to do is to be applicable and usable anywhere. So it's not that I'm not there to serve the country. I hope that what I'm doing can actually be used to serve the country, if you see what I mean. So I hope that that is the case. But thank you. It's very kind of you and your very kind words and all colleagues in Malaysia as well. And I would really be great to get feedback, actually, from colleagues in Malaysia about the things we've developed, you know, which are freely accessible. Tell me how it works and any ideas of how we can actually collaborate. That would be fantastic. In the end of the day, right, urology and patients are the same everywhere in the world, right? We try to address that.
And there are no longer any borders, especially when it comes to research. Thank you so much, Professor Vincent Nyanaprogasam, Professor of Urology at the University of Cambridge, and my co-host, consultant urologist, Dr. George Lee. This has been Health and Living on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.